From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He's been called the madman of Latin music. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from pianist Eddie Palmieri. He's introduced many jazz innovations into Latin music. Palmieri has a new CD called Vortex. Also, British novelist A.S. Byatt. The movie Angels and Insects, based on one of her stories, is now out on home video. We talked about love and the language of love. And film critic John Powers reviews Secrets and Lies, which won this year's top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Last week, it opened the New York Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. An emergency Israeli-Palestinian summit has opened in Washington today. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, and Jordan's King Hussein are participating at the request of President Bill Clinton. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The president called the summit after U.S. officials failed to arrange a meeting between the Israeli and Palestinian leaders in the Mideast. Trust on both sides has been shattered by last week's clashes in the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, which left scores of people dead. The administration hopes to restore some trust and get the two sides talking directly to each other again. Mr. Clinton is meeting separately with the Palestinian and Israeli leaders, but is also bringing them together for an expanded dialogue. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak decided not to attend the summit, but in a move that could improve the atmosphere, he said Egypt will go ahead with plans to host a Mideast economic summit, including Israel. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Supreme Court says it'll decide whether states may ban doctor-assisted suicides. This decision prepares the way for a landmark decision in the national debate over the right to die. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a Washington state law last March banning doctor-assisted suicide. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals struck down two New York laws also barring the practice. That appellate court ruled it's discriminatory to prevent terminally ill patients to end their lives with medication, but to allow other dying patients end their lives by following their requests to disconnect life support systems. Both states appealed. Professional Baseball's American League filed an injunction today in federal court ordering major league umpires back to work. Martin Wells of member station WHYY reports.
Cleveland plays at Baltimore in one game in the American League playoff series this afternoon. Texas visits New York tonight. Those games will go on with or without American League umpires. The umpires voted to boycott the playoffs until Baltimore Orioles second baseman Roberto Alomar begins serving a 5-game suspension. Alomar received the suspension for spitting in the face of umpire John Hirschbeck during Friday's game in Toronto. He's being allowed to play while the suspension is being appealed. If the court rules the umpires do not have to go back to work, the American League has what it calls a backup plan. A spokeswoman would only say the league hopes the umpires go back to work, but if they don't, the games will go on. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Wells in Philadelphia.
A private business group says a key gauge of future economic activity rose last month to a new high. The Conference Board says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.2% in September to 103.3. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up a fraction of a point at 5,882. Trading's moderate. This is NPR. The European Union is escalating its dispute with the United States over trade with Cuba. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The EU's foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg decided to challenge the U.S. over the Helms-Burton Act at the World Trade Organization, the international body set up to oversee trade disputes. Among other things, the Helms-Burton Act allows naturalized U.S. citizens to sue foreign companies they feel have profited from investing in what they consider to be property confiscated by the Cuban government. When Helms-Burton was passed in July, America's main trade partner set off a chorus of diplomatic disapproval. The EU plans to file the complaint on October 16th. The Europeans had previously indicated they would wait until after the U.S. election before challenging Helms-Burton. British Foreign Secretary Malcolm Rifkin says U.S. elections should not determine EU policy. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
welfare overhaul efforts get started today. The states of Wisconsin and Michigan both got approval last night to implement their major reform programs. More than a dozen states have submitted programs to the federal government for approval. Under the new law signed by President Clinton last August, states can design and run their own welfare programs, but these programs must be certified before they will receive federal funding. The new federal law limits welfare benefits to 5 years total per person. Recipients must also find work within 2 years unless they receive a hardship waiver. Reform Party presidential candidate Ross Perot appears in federal court today, fighting to join the presidential debates. A bipartisan commission voted to exclude him, saying it didn't believe Perot had a realistic chance of being elected. The decision prompted the suit. The first presidential debate is this Sunday in Hartford, Connecticut. Perot's also complained to the FCC, charging the major TV networks won't sell him airtime to broadcast his campaign commercials in primetime. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pianist Eddie Palmieri has been given many nicknames. He's been called the Latin Monk because of his Thelonious Monk-inspired dissonances. He's been called the Piano Breaker Man because he hits the keys so hard. He's even been called the Madman of Latin music. He's taken many of the innovations of modern jazz pianists and brought them into his Latin bands. But he's never stopped playing good dance music. Palmieri grew up in New York, where his parents had moved from Puerto Rico. He's been leading his own jazz salsa groups since 1961. He's won several Grammys. Now he has a new CD called Vortex. Eddie Palmieri was born in Spanish Harlem in 1936. He moved with his family to the South Bronx when he was seven. When I spoke with him in 1994, I asked him to compare the two neighborhoods.
Oh, well, they were different at that time. The Hispanic movement was certainly into the El Barrio, what they call, and we moved there when we were, I was 5 years old, and by 7 years old, I was already being accompanied by my brother playing piano. He was 9 years older than me. And my brother passed away in 88, 60 years young. But then when we moved to the Bronx, then my father being a genius as far as being a radio and television repairman and plumber and everything you could think had to do with manual labor, he worked very, very hard all his life. And my mother was a seamstress. My mother arrived in New York in 1925. My father in 26, he wasn't able to court her in Puerto Rico because of my grandmother with the broom.
And, your grandmother with the, your with father the couldn't court your mother in Puerto Rico because of your grandmother with the broom.
And smoking cigars, my grandmother smoking a cigar with a limp leg and running after him with the broom. My father figured it's better if he met my mother in New York.
Did your grandmother have something against?
I would certainly say so. Uh-huh. And then the thing is that my father arrived on the next ship a year later, and by 1926 they married, and by 27 my brother was born. I was born in 36. When we arrived in the South Bronx, it was just a beautiful, beautiful neighborhood and lights on all the buildings and in the entrances to the buildings. And It was wonderful experiences. No cars at all. We were able to play stickball and not worry about any cars in the street. It was wonderful years that I remember in the South Bronx.
What did it mean to you to be Puerto Rican when you were growing up? Were you anxious to assimilate? Were you very proud of being Puerto Rican, or just were you just Puerto Rican and not didn't think about it very much one way or another?
Always quite unique being Puerto Rican because of what I saw, the family being so united. When my relatives all came from Puerto Rico, my uncles on, my grandmother, for example, had an open house policy, you know, which meant that on Saturdays, you would see my grandmother going down to the Safeway A&P and doing the shopping. And plus, she would stop at the liquor store and bring about, oh, 6 or 8 bottles of different ryes and rums, whatever, merely because my grandfather was also a professional gambler. So on Saturday night, Friday night, the card games would start. And by midnight on Saturday, there was no liquor stores open. And the only one that had the liquor was Grandma. And as she sold you a liquor, she would light up a cigar. And then my grandfather was quite unique in playing, so he would clean up, and they would have a house kitty. And on top of that, my uncles who worked in the leather factories, they would bring my grandfather, these armbands and suspenders that he would put on with a little hammer and a copper cup there. He would put the little brass tips on them. And that was how he made his living. And on Saturdays, all my uncles would get together, and then they would take out the guitars, and they would start to sing. By 13, I was already playing drums with my uncle, Chino Gates, y su alma tropical, because I didn't want to play the piano anymore. I wanted to become my brother's drummer.
Now, I know when you were growing up, your mother really wanted you to play piano, but you wanted to play drums.
Right.
Let's start with your mother wanting you to play piano. Why was she so big on that?
Well, because she passed the Depression here, and actually, in 1929, she was here already. She arrived in 25. And a lesson was 25 cents, and the idea was you could, you know, try to get the 25 cents. With $1.25, they made a whole grocery shopping. It's amazing what happened in the years of the Depression. And because my brother was already playing piano, and he's 9 years older than me, then my mother certainly insisted on me to play piano, too, and I did. And I couldn't thank her, you know, enough for that.
Now, I read that your mother said that she thought piano lessons would help keep you off the streets. Did it?
Oh, of course. And not only that, but it saved me from having these rumbles in the schoolyard on Saturday night, because I would work with my uncle. You know, my first pay with my uncle was $1.25. But I miss being in the schoolyard, which meant that at Saturday nights, you would get in the schoolyards, and then there would be like 2 rival clubs and that, or 2 clubs, whatever. And the pastime with, well, all right, Eddie, you fight John, you know, today. You know, that's the idea. And, you know, getting punched around isn't quite enjoyable on a Saturday night. I'd rather be playing music.
Now, when you were playing in your uncle's band, you were in your early teens. What did you play in the band?
Oh, I played timbales. And my uncle sang. My other uncle played conga. And we had 2 guitars, a tres and a second guitar who sang, a trumpet, and the bass player, Nicolas. When there wasn't enough money to pay the bass player, Nicolas was out.
Now, you studied classical music when you were young, right, on the piano?
Well, because of Miss Margaret Bonds. She was a classical concert player. And by 11, I gave a concert recital at Carnegie Hall Recital Hall. But remember, like, all those years from 11 to 12, I just wanted to play drums. So it hurt me from not really getting into the fundamentals of the instrument as I need to and I do now.
So when you were playing timbales in your uncle's band, what was the atmosphere like? You were, I don't know, 13 or 14,
oh,
and
he
was playing in dance halls?
Yeah, dance halls and up in the Villas. The Villas is like the Borscht circuit, you know, the Catskills here. You know?
You were playing in the Borscht Belt when you were 13 or 14?
No, but in the Spanish ones.
They were the Spanish Borscht Belt.
Yeah, they were owned by Spaniards at that time. That was where they call them La Villas. And
this is in the Catskill Mountains of New York, where a lot of summer resorts are?
This is Plattekyl, off Newburgh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I started working up there in 1950, 51. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable.
So what was the atmosphere like? What kind of people did you meet?
Well, I'll give you an idea. When the first day I got there, I went to see the pool. They told me they had a pool in this villa, and I went to see the pool. There was a cow drinking and one in the pool.
A cow?
Yeah.
What was a cow doing drinking from the
well,
pool?
Well, I don't know. I didn't know her name was Elsie at that time, so I didn't, you know. From Borton's Milk. The main thing is that that was the cows that gave you the milk. For $35, you could stay a week at the Villas, room and board, and that fresh milk pitcher was there in the morning. And then my uncles and my grandfather would love to go up there because they could gamble up there. They could play cards all day long or dominoes, and that was their world. And my uncle was booked as the music of the Villas, and I was part of that. So that was the way we made a living.
Did you drink when you were young?
No, but my uncle certainly did. And I always tried to, like, grab a drink or so, you know, but it was difficult because all my aunts were there and they were tattletale on my mother.
Right.
He said, sure, that's it, my mother.
Pianist and bandleader Eddie Palmieri is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with pianist Eddie Palmieri. When you were young, you played with Tito Rodriguez. What did you learn about showmanship and running a band from watching him?
He was the one. He was the dandy. He was the dandy because no one dressed like him.
How did he dress?
Oh, immaculately, man. You know, so hip, and he was so sharp. The orchestra all uniform, because he was the best singer that we had here as far as a rumbero singer of an orchestra leader, and he had the preparation to do it, and he just kept improving constantly because of his competitive edge, and you know, that he always had with Mr. Tito Puente. If Tito Puente played vibes, Tito Rodriguez went to learn how to play vibes. You know, it was one of those things that he just couldn't stand. They could, you know, one mostly Tito Rodriguez towards Tito Puente. There was something that just irked him, you know. But when I was working with him from the year 58 to 60, I certainly learned a tremendous amount from Mr. Tito Rodriguez, and may he rest in peace. But he knows that he's in my heart.
What did you wear in the band?
Oh, all different kinds of uniforms. Sometimes we looked like waiters, you know, and they would ask us for a drink and that, and you know, and I would give them my drink and take the tip or something like that. The main thing is, or tuxedos, but we worked because with Tito at that time, then we didn't stay working in what they call the circuit. He went to Vegas, and we did Vegas, and he had a show. His wife was Oriental Japanese, and she sang, and he had a Cuban dancer, Malta, and we did a... He was after that Desi Arnaz, Lucille Ball movement, since he knew Desi, and he knew Lucille Ball because his wife also came from one of those show cabarets. But he was so sharp, you know, and he could dance, and the thing was, he could sing.
Dime cuando tú verás que te adoro tanto y tanto. No sé si tú lo sabrás que eres mía y nada más. Cuando tú lo notarás, me pregunto cuándo y cuándo. Si me miras al pasar, mis ojos te lo dirán. El tic-tac del reloj.
When did you feel ready to form your own band?
1960, after I left Tito Rodriguez. It took about a year. And then by 1961, I started my different forms of orchestra. But La Perfecta started in late 61. Which was the orchestra then that stood together for 7-8 years. And we had two trombones, flute, wooden flute, and timbales, conga, bass, singer, and I, with a total of 8.
Were trombones unusual for a Latin band?
At that time, yes. They called us like the sound of the roaring elephants.
So did when people compared your sound to elephants, was that in praise?
Oh, well, in praise and in annoyance, you know, it was a combination of both because we were playing up in the Catskills for 3 summers with that orchestra, and that's a really commercial a setting, and the orchestra certainly didn't belong there, but we needed to be there because that was the way we would be able to maintain our status in the city by being away for the summer. Like Machito would go to the Concord, and Tito Puente would go to the President Hotel in Swan Lake or whatever, and we landed up in Kutch's Country Club, and then I landed up in Brown's, and then I landed up eventually in 65 in the Raleigh Hotel, and that's where they called us the Roaring Elephants.
Now, a lot of the hotels that you mentioned had primarily Jewish clientele vacationing there.
Right. That's why I told you before, sometimes and most was quite annoying.
were you used to seeing people who weren't Latin doing the cha-cha, the mambo and everything? And I wonder what you thought of their dancing.
Oh, no, of course, because in the 50s, remember that the Jewish clientele was the clientele in the Palladium on Wednesdays.
Oh.
And what we saw was not only the Jewish clientele dancing to the most incredible dances that you can find, but you saw Marlon Brando there. You saw him playing bongos with Tito Puente. I mean, you saw things in the 50s you wouldn't believe. And then the mambo with Tito Puente again and Tito Rodriguez and Machito. These were great orchestras that the Jewish clientele followed. On Friday and Saturday, the Palladium was more Hispanic. And on Sunday, it was definitely Black. So we had 4 different days there that we had 4 different unique ethnic groups coming to dance, and they all danced superbly.
I want to play one of your classic recordings. I want to play Puerto Rico.
Oh, I love it. We just did that in Puerto Rico just now.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, let me play an early recording of it. And this is my guest, Eddie Palmieri, his band. He's featured, of course, on piano. What stage were you at when you recorded that?
Oh, I was in quite an incredible stage, always with the economical pressures around you. But I found myself in Puerto Rico, walking on the beach and looking at that beautiful ocean. And that's what the lyrics say. Isla linda bonita con su aguas bendita. You know, beautiful island with your blessed waters surrounding you. So that's a special album and a special year you played for me.
In Latin music, there's a lot of repetition that the piano plays. I think, is that called montuno?
That's exactly right.
So
it's a montuno part, but it's called a guajeo. You'll hear like boom, pi, boom, ping, boom, ping, boom, ping. That would be the guajeo that I'm using there, and I'll use that. The guajeos behind the percussionist, because the least amount of harmonic changes in Latin is where we get the highest degree of synchronization, which is what you're after. We simplify the chord changes, and there we get what we call el masacote, which is the synchronization of the rhythm section and the piano and bass, so that we're featuring that soloist that is showcasing himself, or that I'm showcasing on the record, or in live, you know, live presentation to the public.
Play something from your new album, Palmas. And you have a piece on here called Bolero Dos.
Right.
And it opens with an extended piano solo. And, I mean, there's no rhythm behind you
right.
in this piano solo, which is very unusual in Latin music. I mean, the rhythm never stops in Latin music.
Well, I've always done that since the Son of Latin Music that won the first Grammy. It's just piano alone.
Now, why do you go for that?
Oh, I mentioned that before. I love variations of a theme. and I know exactly what's going to come behind me, but it's such a beautiful melody that why not play with the, you know, piano first? And there's never been a piano opening or intro that has annoyed or not brought in an audience. So when you're in an audience that your rhythm can be not annoying, but certainly complicated, it's wonderful to hear a piano first. And we just, you know, like I'll just sip it in, you know, like by playing piano, and then all of a sudden, then I'll go into my orchestra, and it's been very, very well accepted, and I love to do it, and it's more pianistic. So it's it helps me in my direction of getting to know my instrument better and better.
Well, let's hear the beginning of Bolero Dos. This is Eddie Palmieri on piano. We could hear you growl on that solo.
I told you, I warned you.
how did you start growling like that?
Well, let me tell you what happened. My first recording, you know, we started to record years ago. First recording, Allegri. And all of a sudden, I see the owner walking with the engineer, and he walks in, and I said, what's the matter? He goes, what is that? You know, and what is what? You know, and we start looking for something that nobody can, you know, what is what? And we start looking. Sure enough, we go back to record, and he comes back, and what is that? You know, and finally they found out it was me. So then they didn't know what to do with me. Either gag me or put some kind of they wanted to gag me. Either that or put, you know, like cover the piano. And they did everything with the piano until later on in the other recordings, different, you know, and said, let it be. That's the way he sounds. And you know, that's him. Let it go. Let it go. What are you going to do? You know, don't gag him. You probably choke him.
Were you aware of the fact that you growled before the engineer mentioned it?
Not like that. You know, it's really your proof is when you hear it back. You say, what is that? You know, but it's just that inner, you know, that spirit inside. And it gives me like some kind of an ambience for myself when I play. And it helps. And I just can't help it. It's just me.
Eddie Palmieri, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear Terry, and I want to wish you the best in the city of brotherly love, and now after talking to you, it's sisterly love.
Eddie Palmieri, recorded in 1994. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a conversation about the language of love and a close encounter with electrocution. We talk with novelist A.S. Byatt. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Secrets and Lies, this year's top prize winner at the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have an interview with A.S. Byatt. The movie Angels and Insects, based on one of her stories, just came out on video. Her latest novel, Babel Tower, is about language and how it's often used to divide us. Her 1991 novel, Possession, was a surprise bestseller in the States and also won England's most prestigious literary award, the Booker Prize. Part detective story, part academic novel, part satire, it was about two scholars who are each researching a Victorian poet. The academics discover their respective Victorian poets were lovers, and then the academics fall in love with each other. The novel compared how the Victorians wrote of love with how we talk about love today. Last June, I asked A.S. Byatt what interested her in how Victorians expressed their love.
Well, they believed it mattered. I think they did have a religious sense of what love was. The religious life of Victorian England and the religious life of 19th century France, and certainly the religious life of 19th century America, was completely involved with what people thought they were, even if they were very daring atheists who were rejecting the religious frameworks. So the word love had this sort of absolute, powerful feel to it, because it also meant the love of God, and it was what human beings were for. And what I was trying in Possession to contrast that with was a sense that one of my eldest daughter once said to me, you know, about the man she lives with. She said, I know I love him, but of course we wouldn't use the word because it's become devalued. And it had become devalued, I think, by lots and lots of romantic fiction and by a kind of psychoanalytic analysing of people's emotions so that you can't say anything simply. And the Victorians, I think, were quite terrified of the love they felt, as well as in awe of it.
Have you felt comfortable using the language of love in life, or is it more comfortable to use it in literature? I mean, have you ever written passionate love letters, or is that the kind of thing you would only do in fiction form?
I have written passionate love letters, but after a time, a kind of self-parody and a kind of self-mockery gets into it, not, I think, because of the woman I am, but because of the writer I am. Because one of the terrible things about people's passionate love letters is that every single person's passionate love letter resembles everybody else's. It is not one of the areas in which you, on the whole, say something new or strange. You go down a very fine channel, and you always feel that you're the only person that's ever been there. In fact, almost everybody's been there. So love letters are quite difficult to write. It's very interesting if you read anthologies of love letters. The great ones are often written by people about to be executed, and they're really death letters, and there's suddenly somebody trying to tell somebody that they really care about them, even there, even in the tower, about to be executed. Whereas the sort of feeling of waking up and realizing, oh my God, there is somebody in my life who has become absolutely all-important to me and I can't see anybody else because they're in the way of them. It's partly wonderful, and partly it's a kind of machinery and there's an end to it. I think what I really like is writing letters to somebody you really know and love, who is interested in every little thing you think and say. But when you start saying, I love you this way and I love you that way, how do I love you? Let me count the ways, as Elizabeth Barrett Browning said. I think you quite quickly become a bit boring, at least to the writer in yourself.
Did you ever get a love letter and think, well, this is a cliche, this isn't really very interesting, the writing isn't very good?
I've had both sorts, yes. I had a most wonderful love letter from a man I didn't like at all. And what do you do about that?
What did you do about that?
I put it in a drawer and got on with my life.
Right.
But I remember the letter, you see. I remember his letter, and I can hardly remember his face.
Well, do you remember it by heart?
Well, it began with quoting a poem by Carey, I think it's Carey, one of the 17th century poets, about at last, you know, I've found the not impossible she that shall possess my heart and me. And I'd always wanted somebody to write me a letter that began with that quote, and this completely wrong man did. He was a very beautiful man, but you could see from sort of the other side of a room that he was very dangerous and not the sort of person you should ever get to know. And he drew a great big blue hand, his own hand, over this letter. I've probably still got it somewhere, but I don't know where. I never consciously threw it away. I just lost it, which is what I always do with letters.
You know what you're saying about how so many expressions of love kind of become cliché? It's very frustrating if you feel you can't rise above that, because that leaves you two choices. One is to try to express yourself and get stuck in clichés, and the other is to be mute.
Well, the third is irony, really. I was talking about Umberto Eco a bit ago, and there's a famous thing he says that bears repeating. He said, you know, in our ironic postmodern world, you can't go and say to a woman, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. He says, but you can put it in context by saying, as Barbara Cartland would say, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. He says, then the woman has been told, A, that you're far too sophisticated to utter this cliche, but nevertheless you have uttered it with your ironic disclaimer. And she knows you love her. He says, you've got it always that way. But I don't quite like doing it that way either. What I do like to do in a novel, which is why love in novels is better than life, I like love to hit people when they weren't expecting it, which is a nice thing to do in fiction.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel. It's called Babel Tower. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with A.S. Byatt, her new novel is called Babel Tower. You taught English literature for, what, 11 years?
Yes, well, full time. I've been teaching since I was about 22, either full time or part time, but I only taught full time for 11 years.
Right, and so you were, I think, 48 years old when you left the university as a full time professor to be a more full-time writer. What was the turning point there that made you think, now's the time, I'm going to do it now?
I thought it was because the government was actually paying everybody to take early retirement. And, what happened was that everybody who could do anything else, which meant that a lot of the very interesting people rushed at this money and went off and did something else and put the money in the bank. I mean, my early retirement money is still in the bank because I never... In fact, I immediately began to earn a very great deal more by writing after one dreadful and frightening year. But I think deeper than that, I went into teaching full time in order to pay my son's boarding school fees because I was worried about sending him to the local school. And both my husbands said, if you want him to go to a paying school, you must get a job. So I got a university post. And then he was killed the week I got the post by a car, by a drunk driver. And I stayed with the job I had taken on because it seemed, the formality of the teaching seemed a way of coping with the grief. And my youngest child was born in the January of the academic year I started teaching, and I started teaching in the September. My son was killed in the July before that. And I now see I actually taught until my youngest daughter was exactly as old as my son had been. And that seemed to be the end of that. That seemed to be somehow the end of it.
What do you make of that? That you taught for 11 years, the age that your son was when he died.
I think it was to do with my little daughter, really. I think when she got to be beyond 11, that was the end of that phase of my life, if you see what I mean. I actually think I was in mourning for 11 years, and teaching was a very good way of living because, the glory of students is that they're extremely self-centred and you have to pay them attention and you haven't got any time to have feelings about yourself. And then after a bit, I began to see that I could get back to writing more gleefully. And then I began to feel I've got to get out.
I would like you to read a paragraph from your new novel. This is from the beginning. It's not the very beginning, but it's near the beginning of the book. And this is where the main character is telling about her sister's death.
She's telling a young poet she's met by accident. Frederica tells him about her sister's death. He realizes that this narrative is practiced. This is the way she has found it convenient, possible, to tell it. Her sister, she says, was married to a vicar and had two small children. And the cat brought in a bird, a sparrow, which took refuge under the refrigerator, and her sister had pulled it out and reached under it, and the fridge was not properly earthed. She was very young, says Frederica. Afterwards, she says wryly, we all suffered from shock. Shock waves, she says grimly, waves and waves of shock. How terrible, says Hugh Pink, prevented from imagining by Frederica's matter-of-fact tone.
Now, I believe that you were nearly killed in the way that you just described by a refrigerator.
Yes, I was. I have a nice, neat, small, square scar on the upper part of the inside of my left arm to prove it.
What happened?
Exactly what happens in the novel. My large cat, which was called Proust, brought in a sparrow. The sparrow got on the top of a cupboard where it just sat all day. And it got to be midnight, and I said, I've got to get this bird out of the kitchen because I've locked the cat out and it can't get in. So I got on a chair and tried to frighten the bird off the cupboard, and it flew under the refrigerator. So I pulled the refrigerator out, and the side of the casing of the refrigerator sort of curved under, and the bird was standing on the edge of this. So when I pulled the refrigerator, the bird went with it. So I lay on the floor and stretched my left arm in, and it was immediately sort of burnt all the way up. The skin was burnt, and I was shaken about. The fridge was obviously not properly earthed. But my...
Grounded is the word we use in America, I think, just to clarify that. Yeah.
Yeah, the fridge was not properly grounded. And my ex-husband, who is nothing if not efficient, turned it off. He turned the switch off. So I was able to retreat rather shaken from under there. And the beautiful bit of this story, which never got into the novel, is that we were then living under the wall of Durham Cathedral, where the venerable Bede is buried. And Bede describes human life in terms of a sparrow, which flies in out of the dark and goes across the lighted room and flies out into the dark. And this damn bird, which was a sparrow, flew out into the dark against the wall of the cathedral under which Bede's tombstone lies. And it was a magical moment, but of course I couldn't put it in the novel, because in the novel the character was not in Durham.
Right. But you actually succeeded in freeing the bird.
Yes, it flew away. It really flew out. It flew out and away. I don't know what it did then, because it was midnight, or by then a bit later. And I did actually think, which interested me a great deal, because I did think, this is it. I'm going to die. And then I thought, what will happen to the children? And it interested me, you know, if you talk about altruism, you always wonder how much you really would put your children first. And at that moment, I did have this complete vision of these two children sleeping quietly upstairs, and what on earth would happen to them.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel, which is called Babel Tower. In an interview you did for the New York Times, you said that you didn't speak to anyone voluntarily until you were about 16. And I found that really interesting, since you're so obsessed with language, the fact that you felt so uncomfortable speaking.
I used to read. I think partly the reason I was uncomfortable speaking was that I had a sort of enormous vocabulary, which until I started speaking, I assumed everybody had. You know, people used to look at me oddly when I spoke to them, because I would talk as though I was just reading, coming out of a novel by Sir Walter Scott. Or, this is a slight joke, but it's partly a truth as well. And it's also, actually, I don't know quite where I got it from. I think my mother had a kind of social fear. I did expect to be unacceptable as a person, and I don't know where that came from.
So were you very, you must have friends, right?
Not a lot. I had one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I was never quite really sure they were my friends, and I had a sort of philosophical and provisional sense that at any moment they might cease to be my friend. I had one friend who is now dead, to whom I dedicated Still Life because she was the original of Stephanie. But I don't know. I mean, I think I could also truthfully say that the life inside books was much richer and more interesting than most of the conversations you had with girls at school about crushes on other girls or hockey or what, you know, what was wrong with the teachers.
So what changed for you when you were 16 that made you more verbal?
I don't know.
More
16
talkative.
Is the right age, really. Mm-hmm. I think I spoke even less at 16. I think what made me more verbal was going to Cambridge, was going to university, was finding myself in a verbal world where lots of people, not just me, most people, I thought, cared about thinking, expected to talk about interesting, complicated things. And I thought I might not be such an oddity, and I wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of people just like me. It was great. And the other thing, of course, is that I did find and do find men easy to talk to. I think because my father was much easier to talk to than my mother, if he was ever there.
Mm-hmm. Your sister, Margaret Drabble, is also a celebrated novelist. Are there parts of your lives that you shared, like from childhood, that you've both written about in really different ways?
I don't think we read each other's novels. I read one of hers. I mean, I read about the first three of hers, and then I had a horrible experience, which I will describe. If you're a writer, you collect certain things which glitter at you, which you know are going to be parts of novels. And there was a peculiarly, I then thought, ugly, bright yellow vase, which moved around from room to room in the houses we lived in. And I was always going to put this vase, because I think because its proportions were wrong, into a novel. It was too bright, it was too bright a yellow. And then to my horror, I found this vase sitting in a novel by my sister and saw that I couldn't have it. And this revealed to me that there would be and were all sorts of other deeper and more important things that if I read them in her book, I would never be able to write. So we then had an agreement that we wouldn't read each other's books. I mean, we did actually sort of talk to each other about this, and we sort of thought we would. And she, when she was doing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, felt impelled to have to read The Virgin in the Garden because she was putting in my generation of writers, they're not hers. So she wrote me a letter saying, I have had to read The Virgin in the Garden because, you see, I couldn't do the... and I have to tell you, I think it is a very, very good novel. And I thought it was terribly nice of her to write me this letter. but I knew exactly why she hadn't read it before. and we go along quite well but like that. I mean, there may be other vases.
I can really understand this. I really can. Though I imagine you're also dying of curiosity at the same time.
Partly. Every now and then I pick one of hers up in a bookstore and read six or seven pages to see if I come across something I recognize by accident.
Uh-huh.
And I did once. I sort of came across one of her characters saying, everybody describes me as a nice woman. What can be more boring than to be described as a nice woman? And I thought, exactly. But mostly I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I read a bit once where she described a woman who got out of a car into a flyover, into a motorway where you shouldn't be on foot. And I thought it was a terribly good bit of writing. But then I put the book down in the bookshop and got on with whatever I was doing.
Right. We only have about a minute left. I have one more question I want to ask you. Why have you chosen to use A.S.? By it as your writing name instead of your full name?
It's complicated, really. It just struck me as being what you did when I started writing. I think largely because of a sort of passionate admiration for T.S. Eliot.
Mm.
And I don't think I wanted to be thought not to be a woman, but I do think that even then I didn't want to be a woman novelist, you know, with capital letters. And I think to that extent it was... an attempt not at not being a woman, but at some sort of anonymity. And then in the 60s, when I had my small children, and I got very gloomy and thought, you're never going to write a novel, I thought I would call my eldest daughter Antonia and she could write the novel. And this has been really a very, very silly thing to do. She's now a very beautiful woman and runs the South Bank Literature Department in London. She runs the whole literary readings there very brilliantly. And she, as far as I'm concerned, is Antonia Byatt, and I am A.S. And my grandchildren address me as A.S. They ring me up on the telephone and say, A.S., are you there? And that is how I think of myself now.
Well, that's interesting. But your full name is Antonia.
Yeah, Antonia Susan.
Oh, very interesting. I thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
A.S. Byatt's latest novel is Babel Tower. The movie Angels and Insects, based on one of her stories, has just come out on video. Our interview was recorded last June. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie Secrets and Lies. This is Fresh Air. As Mike Leigh's new movie Secrets and Lies opens around the country, the independent British director might finally have his breakthrough film. His best-known movies, High Hopes, Life is Sweet, and Naked, have won him critics' praise, but only a small, loyal following here. John Powers has this review.
When Secrets and Lies won the top prize at Cannes last May, something remarkable happened. Nobody booed, not even the French. For Mike Leigh's new movie is so hilarious and wrenching that just about everyone likes it. It's set in motion by a black London optometrist named Hortense. An adopted child, Hortense discovers that her birth mother, Cynthia, is actually a white woman. This discovery sends out shockwaves of honesty that change everyone. Her newfound mother, Cynthia, Cynthia's embittered daughter, Roxanne, Cynthia's good-hearted brother, Morris, and Morris's wife, Monica, a woman caught in the spin cycle of suburban joylessness. They're all isolated. Devoured by inner wounds, they're terrified to bring into the open. Secrets and Lies runs almost 2.5 hours. It's a domestic epic, you might say. And except for a couple of scenes, it flies right by. The story has the riveting ferocity of a psychodrama. The films of Ingmar Bergman and John Cassavetes come to mind. But it isn't grim. It's filled with sad things that make you laugh, and funny things that bring tears to your eyes. Even when the characters are most aggressively unhappy, their traumas are tinged with freakish comedy. As when Cynthia gives her white daughter, Roxanne, a little maternal advice.
You want to get yourself a bloke. That's what you want to do.
I've told you, I don't want to get anything. I'm quite happy here, thank you very much.
When I was your age, I could have had the pick of the crop.
Well, why didn't you?
Because I lost my poor mother, that's why.
Oh, here we go.
I was stuck at home here from the age of 10, looking after Morris and your granddad.
Yeah, we know.
Then I got saddled with you. That was my downfall, darling.
I didn't ask to be born.
No, and I never asked to have you neither.
Well, you should have thought about that before you dropped your knickers.
Mike Leigh has been making movies for 25 years, but it's only in the last 10 that he's been recognized as the most original filmmaker working in England. Rather than write scripts in advance, he and his actors spend months inventing characters, which Leigh eventually turns into a story. It's a daring way to work, and it produces acting that cuts deep to the bone. Marianne Jean-Baptiste is wonderfully sympathetic in the quietly tricky role of Hortense, the one character who sees things clearly. It's no wonder Lee makes her an optometrist. Superb, too, is Timothy Spall as Morris, a photographer who spends all day telling people to smile. He wants those he loves most to smile, too, but he can only helplessly witness their despair. The movie is dominated by Brenda Blethyn, whose Cynthia is an exhaustingly unforgettable creation. When we first meet her, she seems like a grotesque, a prattling, mewling sad sack. But by the end, we see her as a human being who shares our own pain and longing. Secrets and Lies builds to Roxanne's 21st birthday party, when the family first meets its black relative Hortense. In the wrong hands, this scene could have been a dire English version of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. But Lee's not interested in making cheap points about race. His theme is repression, the secrets and lies that keep everyone in this family in their own hellish solitude. And it's in this climax that Lee's artistry falters. For 2 hours, Secrets and Lies has shown us the heartbreaking mess of life, all the blind spots, pent-up fears, and runaway resentments that collide in the course of everyday living. At the end, though, everything turns neat. The characters have healing catharses right on cue. Morris even gives a little speech explaining the point of the movie. Still, Secrets and Lies is an extremely fine movie. Though it's too good to be true, there's something deeply satisfying about the film's ultimate optimism. We want these lost souls to be sprung from their loneliness. For we've been swept away by performances whose twisted humor and emotional nakedness make us feel the fragility of the human heart.
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Sherrock. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Cherry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, traumatic brain injury and coma, we talk with neurosurgeon Jam Gajar. He recently helped save the life of a woman who was severely beaten in Central Park. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.